him, I thought, he looks funny. And sure enough, he hadn't paused in mid-stroke at all. He had passed out, and his lungs had filled with water. I pulled him out of the pool and called for an ambulance. I pushed on his stomach, and the water poured from his mouth as from a spigot. I waited for him to open an eye and wink, start laughing, turn this real-life event into something that it wasn't, into something truly awful and funny, something to look back on and laugh about. I held his hand and waited. I waited a long time. My father's death, take four. And so, finally, it happened like this. Stop me if you've heard this one. My father was dying, sheltered inside an oxygen tent at Jefferson Memorial Hospital. His small, emaciated body seemed bleak and translucent, a kind of ghost already, even then. Mother waited with me, but would leave to talk to the doctors or take walks because her back was hurting. And that would leave me alone with my father, and sometimes I'd take his hand and wait. The doctors, of which there were so many, one referred to them as a team, were all very grave, even hopeless. There was a Dr. Knowles, a Dr. Milhauser, a Dr. Vincetti. Each was a specialist famous in his field. Each kept an eye on that part of my father that was his specialty and reported his findings to Dr. Bennett, our old family doctor, who, as captain of the team, was a generalist. He synthesized the details of their ongoing reports, filled in whatever blanks they may have left out, whereupon he would give us the big picture. He sometimes flattered us by using the words he had gone to school to learn. Renal failure, for instance, and chronic hemolytic anemia. This last, this anemia, he described as being particularly debilitating, as the body retained excessive amounts of iron, creating a need for periodic blood transfusions, an inability to assimilate red blood byproducts, skin discoloration, and an extreme sensitivity to light. For this reason, even though he was in a deep coma, the lights in my father's room were always kept quite low. The fear was, were he ever to come out of this coma, the shock of all the bright lights would kill him. Old Dr. Bennett had an old, tired face. The rings beneath his eyes were like dark brown ruts in a road. He had been our doctor for years, for I don't know how long. But he was a good doctor, and we trusted him. "I'll tell you," he said to us that night, his hand on my shoulder, our friendship deepening as we watched my father's condition deteriorate. "I want to speak to you candidly now." He looked at me, then at Mom, and seemed to think it over again before he spoke. "Mr. Bloom may not make it out of this one," he said. And my mother and I, almost in unison, said, "I see." He said, "There are a couple of things we want to try. We're not giving up, not by a long shot. But I've seen this sort of thing before. It's sad. I've known Edward Bloom for a quarter of a century. I don't feel like his doctor anymore. I feel like a friend, you know? A friend who wishes he could do something. But without the machines..." Dr. Bennett said and shook his sad head once, not finishing the sentence and never starting it with an ending in mind. I turned and wandered away while he continued to talk to my mother. I went to my father's room and sat in the chair beside his bed. I sat there and waited, for what I don't know, and stared at those marvelous machines. This wasn't life, of course. This was life support. This was what the medical world had fashioned to take the place of purgatory. I could see how many breaths he was taking by looking at a monitor. I could see what his frenetic heart was up to. And there were a couple of wavy lines and numbers I wasn't sure about at all, but I kept an eye on them as well. In fact, after a while, it was the machines I was looking at, not my father at all. They had become him. They were telling me his story. Which reminds me of this joke. I'll always remember his jokes, but this one especially I will remember. It's a family heirloom. It's one I tell myself still, out loud and alone, the way he told it to me. I say, there's this man. Now, there's this man, and he's a poor man, but he needs a new suit. Now, this man needs a new suit, but he can't afford to buy one. He can't afford to buy one until he passes a store where there's this suit on sale, and it's priced just right. This beautiful dark blue suit with pinstripes. And so he buys it. Just like that, he buys it and wears it right out of the store with a matching tie and everything. But the joke here is, and I guess I should have mentioned this earlier, the joke is it doesn't fit. This suit doesn't fit him at all. It's simply way too big, but it's his suit, right? It's his suit. So to make it look good, he has to place an elbow against his side like this, and his other arm out sort of like this, and he has to walk without moving one of his legs so that the cuffs will appear even, this tiny man in this huge suit, which, as I said, he walks out into the street wearing, and he thinks to himself, what a nice suit I have, and walks with his arms just so. My father would make his arms just so, and dragging one leg behind with this smile on his face like an idiot because of this great buy he's just made, a suit, on sale. When he passes two old women on the avenue there, they watch him pass, and one of them shakes her head and says to the other, what a poor, poor man. And the other woman says, yes, but what a nice suit. Which is the end of this joke. But I can't tell it like my father did. I can't drag my leg the way he did it. And so even though this is the funniest joke I have ever heard in my life, I don't laugh. I can't. Even when the lady says, yes, but what a nice suit. Now I'm not laughing. I'm not laughing at all. I'm doing the other thing. I suppose this is what roused him, brought him back to the world for a bit, thinking that if there was any time I needed a joke, now was the time. God, he really cracked me up. I look at him, and he looks at me.
Some water, he says to me. Get me some water.
Some water, he says. Oh, and it's his voice, all right. It's his voice, deep and booming, caring and gentle. Mom, bless her heart, is still out talking to the doctor. And I get him some water, and he calls me over to his bed, his only son, me, his only child, and he pats a place on the edge of the bed where I'm to sit, right? So I sit. There's no time for hellos and how are yous, and we both know it. He wakes up and just looks at me in the chair where I am, and then he pats a place on his bed where I'm to sit. I sit, and he says, after taking a sip of water from the little plastic cup,
son, he says, I'm worried.
And he says it in this real shaky voice, so I know, don't ask me how, but I know, that machines or not, this will be the last time I ever see him alive. Tomorrow, he'll be dead. And I say, what is it you're worried about, Dad? The hereafter? And he says,
no, dummy. I'm worried about you. He says, you're an idiot. You couldn't get yourself arrested without me along to help.
But I don't take it personal. He's trying to be funny. He's trying to be funny, and this is the best he can do. Now I know he's a goner. And I say, well, don't worry about me, Dad. I'll be okay. I'll be fine. And he says,
I'm a father. I can't help it. A father worries. I am a father, he says,
so I don't miss his point.
And as a father, I've tried to teach you a thing or two. I really did try. Maybe I wasn't around so much, but when I was, I tried to teach. So what I want to know is, you think I did a good job?
And as I'm opening my mouth to speak, he says,
wait, don't answer that.
He says, giving a smile his best shot, but it doesn't quite work. He can't really make one anymore. And so he says to me, dying on the bed in front of me, this man, my father, says,
"Oh, go on then. Just tell me before I die. Tell me what it is I've taught you. Tell me everything it is I've taught you about life so I can go ahead and die and so I won't have to worry so much. Just go ahead and say it."
I look into his gray-blue dying eyes. We're staring at each other, showing each other our last looks. The faces we'll take with us into eternity. And I'm thinking, how I wish I knew him better. How I wish we'd had a life together. Wishing my father wasn't such a complete and utter goddamn mystery to me. And I say, "There's this man," I say. "There's this man, and he's a poor man. But he needs a suit, and..." Big fish. And he smiled. Then he cast his gaze around the room, and he winked at me. He winked.
"Let's get out of here," he said in a hoarse whisper.
"Out of here?" I said.
"Dad, you're in no condition. There's a fold-up wheelchair in the bathroom," he said. "Wrap a blanket around me. As soon as we get off this hall, we'll be in the clear. But we don't have much time. Hurry, son."
I did as he asked. I don't know why. I stepped into the bathroom and saw he was right. There was a wheelchair behind the bathroom door, folded up like a child's stroller. I unfolded it and wheeled it to his bed, where I wrapped him with a pale brown blanket, covering his head like a monk's habit. I lifted him, with a disturbing ease, from his bed and into the chair. I'd gotten no stronger in the last few months, but he had become considerably smaller.
"Go for it," he said.
I opened the door to his room and peeked out into the hallway. I saw Mom at the nurse's desk with Dr. Bennett, wiping her eyes with a tissue and nodding. I pushed my father in the opposite direction. I dared not even look behind me to see if they had spied us. I just pushed him fast, hoping for the best. And when we came to a corner, went around it. Only then did I allow myself a backward view. Nobody. So far, so good.
"So, where are we going?" I asked him, catching my breath.
"The elevators," he said, his voice a little bit muffled below the blanket. "The elevator to the lobby, to wherever you parked your car. Parking deck?"
"Yes," I said.
"Then take me there," he said. "Now! We don't have much time."
The elevator came and I pushed him on. The door closed behind us, and when they opened again, I wheeled him out of there with a daredevil's panache. Past a host of doctors in green and white, past nurses holding charts, giving me sidelong glances, and finally staring. Everybody in the lobby paused and stared at us, knowing this wasn't right somehow. But by then I was traveling at such speed that no one had time to think to stop us. They simply looked at us as though they had seen something odd. And they had, too, odder than they knew. And then we were gone, wheeling toward the parking deck into a cool spring wind.
"Good job," he said.
"Thanks."
"Still need to hurry, though, Will," he said. "I need some water. I need some water bad."
"I have some in the car," I said, "a thermos full."
"More than that," he said and laughed.
"We'll get more," I said.
"I know you will, son," he said. "I know it."
When we got to the car, I lifted him out of the wheelchair and placed him in the front seat. I folded the wheelchair and threw it in the back.
"We won't be needing that," he said.
"We won't?" I said.
"Not where we're going," he said,
and I thought I heard him laugh again.
But he didn't tell me where we were going, not at first. I simply drove away from everything I knew, the hospital, his old office, home. When I looked at him for a clue, he was silent, covered in the blanket.
"That water, William," he said after a minute.
"Oh," I said, "here." It was beside me on the seat. I opened the top and passed it to him. One shaky, scaly hand appeared from beneath the folds and took it from me. But instead of drinking it, he poured it all over himself. The blanket was soaked.
"Ah," he said, "that's the ticket."
Still, he didn't take the blanket off.
"Go north on Highway 1, he told me,
but I had to strain to hear him. His voice was muffled beneath the blanket and seemed to come from far away. "North on Highway 1, I said.
"There's a place there," he said. "There's a river, a place by the river."
"Edwards Grove," I said to myself. And he said,
"What?"
"Nothing," I said. I took the car down a series of streets through the city and the surrounding suburbs, where the sun was rising over the roofs and treetops, until finally we broke into the deep, green, beautiful country. I'd been out this way once before. "How far now?" I asked him.
"Just a couple more miles, I think," he said. "I hope. I don't feel so good."
"What's there?" I asked. But for an answer, all I got was a shivering inside the damp blanket and a gurgling, groaning sound, as if he were in deep pain. "Are you okay?" I asked.
"Been better," he said. "I feel like that guy
who walks into the bar with a frog on his head, with a bird on his shoulder, with a kangaroo at his side, and the bartender says, 'Hey, we don't get that many kangaroos in here.' And the kangaroo says, 'Yeah, and at these prices, you're not likely to get many more.'" And then he said suddenly, almost yelling,
"Here!"
And I pulled off the road. It wasn't Edwards Grove, as far as I know, but it might as well have been. There was your old oak tree with the roots spreading out through the dark and mossy soil. There were your rhododendrons. There was your rabbit hopping away at a leisurely gait, eyeing us with a backward glance. And there was your river, running clear the way you didn't think rivers ran anymore, moving fast around stones the size of a small car, making little rapids, running as clear as the air, as blue as the sky, as white as a cloud. I don't know how he saw it from beneath the blanket.
"Carry me,"
he said, or so it sounded, his voice so weak now I was doing my share of interpreting as I listened. He said, "Carry me," and, "You don't know how I appreciate what you're doing," and, "When you see your mother, tell her. Tell her I said goodbye." And so I carried him out of the car and down the mossy bank to the river and stood there before it, holding my father in my arms. And I knew what I was supposed to do then, but I couldn't do it. I just stood there, holding his body shrouded in a blanket on the banks of this river until he told me, "You might want to look away now," and then, "Please." And all of a sudden, my arms were full of the most fantastic life. Frenetic, impossible to hold on to, even if I'd wanted to, and I wanted to. And then all I was holding was the blanket, because my father had jumped into the river. And that's when I discovered that my father hadn't been dying after all. He was just changing, transforming himself into something new and different to carry his life forward in. All this time, my father was becoming a fish. I saw him dart this way and that, a silvery, brilliant, shining life, and disappear into the darkness of the deep water where the big fish go, and I haven't seen him since, though others have. Already I've heard stories of lives saved and wishes granted.